and welcome to Lakeshore Update. I'm Dee Dotson. On this edition of the podcast, you hear the latest on Lakeshore PBS receiving two Chicago Midwest Emmy Award nominations in the Outstanding Achievement for Arts and Entertainment category. Brandon Smith reports on analysis of Indiana's redistricting maps, and Chris Nolte has a conversation with Paul Schreiner of Project Neighbors about plans to build low-income housing for men in Valparaiso. All of that and more on this edition of Lakeshore Update. The Lakeshore PBS series, Eye on the Arts, has received two Chicago Midwest Emmy Award nominations in the Outstanding Achievement for Arts Entertainment category. This announcement comes on the heels of a nomination in the same category during the 2020 awards. Eye on the Arts is a half-hour program that showcases a diverse range of local artists, arts organizations, and events. The series was nominated for its individual profiles of blacksmith Madison Wise of New Lenox, Illinois, and luthier Luke Elliott of Hebron, Indiana. A luthier is someone who makes stringed instruments such as violins or guitars. Eye on the Arts is produced by VP of Production for Lakeshore PBS, Tony Santucci, with additional segments produced by Justin Hill, Alex Hernandez, and Kevin Lund. Santucci says, quote, "Over six seasons of producing Eye on the Arts, I've learned that passion and drive are the engine that propels all artists. The wealth of talent in our community makes our job easy. We are proud to reflect our community of creative individuals and their work." The television series Eye on the Arts is made possible in part by financial support from Legacy Foundation, NIPSCO, Purdue University Northwest, South Shore Arts, the Indiana Arts Commission, and the National Endowment for the Arts.
You're listening to Lakeshore Update with Dee Dotson.
Mayor Jerome Prince announced the city of Gary will honor the work and legacy of the late Mayor Richard Gordon Hatcher on Monday, October 11th at 11 a.m. on the steps of City Hall. The annual event will be called Mayor Richard Gordon Hatcher Day. Mayor Prince will host members of the Hatcher family, Gary Common Council members, as well as the community. Mayor Prince encouraged city workers to attend the ceremony and spend the day serving their community. He also said it's important to remember all of the advancements Gary residents, especially people of color, made under Mayor Hatcher, who was one of two black men to become mayors of major American cities in 1968. Mayor Hatcher passed away in December 2019. City offices and facilities will be closed on this day, which was previously recognized as Columbus Day in the city. The ceremony will be held on the south side of City Hall, adjacent to the Mayor Hatcher statue.
You're listening to Lakeshore Update with Dee Dotson.
The utility that provides natural gas for most of northern Indiana has asked state regulators to approve a 17% rate increase for its more than 800,000 gas customers. NIPSCO asked the Indiana Utility Regulatory Commission on Wednesday to approve a two-stage rate hike, the first phase of which would take effect on September 1st, 2022. NIPSCO's proposed rate increases for base rates for gas must go through a regulatory review process, which includes an opportunity for public input.
You're listening to Lakeshore Update with Dee Dotson.
October is Domestic Violence Awareness Month, and the Lake County prosecutor, Bernard Carter, says that more than 40% of women and 27% of men experience some form of intimate partner violence at some point in their lives. And he says the COVID-19 pandemic's just made things worse. Carter says in a news release from his office that abusers and victims have been forced to stay home together without much outside interaction or access to victim services. Carter said the isolation, coupled with major increased family stressors like loss of employment or financial strain, can and most likely will lead to an increase of abuse and violence. Carter said people should be aware of telltale signs of abuse that span beyond physical marks and injuries, which include isolation, personality changes, loss of self-esteem, showing anxiety about their relationship, and more.
You're listening to Lakeshore Update with Dee Dotson.
The Porter County Council is asking the county commissioners to approve a comprehensive study of wages and salaries for all county employees. The Times reports the vote came after Sheriff Dave Reynolds made an impassioned plea for 5% raises for county police officers. He says that fewer are applying for the job, so it's even more important to be competitive with other police departments. Council Vice President Mike Jessen says the county has typically waited until the end of budget hearings to see how much is left to spend before offering across-the-board raises. The study takes 6 to 9 months to complete. County Prosecutor Gary German hired a firm last year to look at compensation for his department.
You're listening to Lakeshore Update with Dee Dotson.
Two independent analyses of Indiana's redistricting maps says the districts drawn by Republicans are heavily skewed in favor of Republicans. Indiana Public Broadcasting's Brendan Smith reports those evaluations also say the new state House, Senate, and congressional maps create very few competitive districts.
George Washington University political scientist Christopher Warshaw says Indiana Republicans typically win about 60% of the votes statewide, but will likely win between 70 and 80% of the seats in the new maps. That skew, Warshaw argues, makes them some of the most biased redistricting plans anywhere in the country in the last half century. Republicans, however, tout the compactness of the districts they've drawn, saying they've kept communities of interest together. Princeton University's gerrymandering project isn't so sure. It evaluated district compactness in each of the new maps, and generally it said that compactness is barely middle of the road. And the Princeton analysis says that out of 159 districts across the three plans, just 11 will be competitive. For Indiana Public Broadcasting, I'm Brandon Smith at the State House.
You're listening to Lakeshore Update with Dee Dotson.
Indiana Attorney General Todd Rokita urged federal lawmakers this week not to approve legislation strengthening a federal voting rights law. Indiana Public Broadcasting's Brandon Smith reports on Rokita's testimony before a U.S. Senate committee.
The legislation would strengthen parts of the Voting Rights Act that had been stripped away in the last several years by the U.S. Supreme Court. Supporters say it would make it harder for states to enact voter restriction measures. But Republicans, like Todd Rokita, call it a federal takeover of elections.
S4 seeks to flip this constitutional mandate on its head, turning the Department of Justice into a strengthened federal elections czar, wielding the power to challenge any new or existing election law based on the whims of the party in power, whoever controls the Justice Department. And that should never be.
Rokita pledged to challenge the legislation in court if it becomes law. Republicans in Congress have uniformly lined up to oppose the bill, making its passage unlikely. For Indiana Public Broadcasting, I'm Brandon Smith at the State House.
You're listening to Lakeshore Update with Dee Dotson.
The Internal Revenue Service is reminding an estimated 188,000 Indiana residents who asked for an extension to file their 2020 tax return that they have until October 15th to file and avoid the penalty for filing late. The IRS urges everyone to file electronically in order to avoid delays and speed the processing of their return. IRS spokesperson Stacey Engel says, quote, October 15th is the deadline for just about everyone. Only members of the military and others serving in a combat zone have more time. They normally have 180 days after they leave the combat zone to file and pay any taxes due. There is usually no penalty for failure to file if the taxpayer is due a refund. However, people who wait too long to file and claim a refund risk losing it altogether. The safest and fastest way for people to get a refund is to file electronically and have their refund electronically deposited into their bank or other financial account. Taxpayers can use direct deposit to deposit their refund into one, two, or even three accounts.
You're listening to Lakeshore Update with Dee Dotson.
Indiana is making more than $500 million available to early learning providers across the state. Indiana Public Broadcasting's Jenny Lindsay explains, the grant program aims to stabilize the industry as some providers struggle to keep their doors open.
The Build, Learn, Grow stabilization grants are designed to help providers navigate a wide range of challenges as the pandemic continues. The money can be used to help pay for things like the rent for their buildings, hiring bonuses, or increased pay to recruit more staff, and software to streamline business operations. In total, the state is using federal COVID-19 relief to make $540 million available. In a news release, the Indiana Family and Social Services Administration says the grant awards will cover 3 months of a provider's operating costs, limited to a maximum of $500,000 per site. Applicants have to be currently open and operating to receive a grant through the program. Providers have until December 31st to apply, but FSSA says they should apply as soon as possible to gain immediate access to the funding. For Indiana Public Broadcasting, I'm Jeannie Lindsay.
You're listening to Lakeshore Update with Dee Dotson.
Here's regionally speaking host Chris Nolte with a conversation with Paul Schreiner of Project Neighbors Valparaiso.
Seems that Project Neighbors in Valparaiso always has some housing projects of some type underway, and we're going to find out what the latest projects happen to be. Paul Schreiner is Executive Director of Project Neighbors, and he is joining us from Valparaiso to talk about it. Paul, thank you for being with us on Lakeshore Public Radio.
Glad to do it, Chris.
Well, some interesting things happening these days. I know among them have been helping residents in various states that they may happen to be in, whether it happens to be low-income residents or maybe women that need to help because of problems at home and have family members to take care of. Or I guess in one particular case, we have residents in the Valparaiso area who are recovering from addictions. And I know that is the main goal that the next of the two respite houses is all about. Will you fill us in first about Respite House 2?
Respite House 2 was a project that came up at about 5 o'clock one morning when I went to the gym to do my minimal workout, and I bumped into Mitch Peters. Mitch was the founder and director of the Respite House program at the time, and he and I just began talking, and he mentioned that he was limited to 16 beds in his existing facility, and boy, did he need more because he had a waiting list of 80 to 100 people at all times. Ironically, Project Neighbors, a different organization, had just purchased two adjacent lots on Union Street in Valparaiso, and we just began talking, and one thing led to another. And my board of directors agreed to sell those two lots to Respite House at the cost that we had paid for them and to manage the construction of the new Respite House. Mm-hmm. Flash by a year and a half later, and we're breaking ground, and now flash by another year, and it's all done. And the 22-bed facility is fully occupied, so now Respite House has 22 beds in one spot and 16 in another.
I know that residents in Valparaiso are very familiar with the projects that the Project Neighbors does, but folks outside of the community may not know. And when last time we talked, we were talking about helping women that need assistance someplace safe to live. Will you give us an idea for our listeners that aren't familiar with Project Neighbors does, the way that the projects get started, the needs that you mentioned that have to be covered?
Well, everything is a bit organic. We don't have a narrowly defined mission. One of the things that the founder of the organization did, Walt Reiner, was he would buy old places, fix them up, and find families that otherwise couldn't afford to live here and made it possible for them to live here. Many of those initial investments were for African-American families that desired to get out of the high-rise ghettos, if you will, of Chicago. I think 7 or 8 families found a path to a better life that way. That was 50 years ago. We do continue to construct housing because we see the need as being so desperate, not just for African-Americans, but for lots and lots of people who can't handle the high cost of housing in Valparaiso. And that's not unique to Valparaiso. That's a common problem all over the country. So right now we are endeavoring. Well, let me back up.
Okay.
We started a project aimed at healthcare. We built a building to house what became HealthLink. HealthLink is a federally funded healthcare facility that offers healthcare to people without insurance, with money, without money. We built them a building. It was 11,000 square feet. They outgrew it in 13 years. And because of the benevolent attitude of their director, we purchased that building back at a very, very favorable price, gutted it, and built 18 very small efficiency apartments for single women. Not single women of any particular plight, but anybody that needed very safe, modern housing, but minimal in size, about 300 square feet each unit. Each unit has a full bathroom and a micro kitchen, a small kitchen. When we did that, Housing Opportunities decided they wanted to do the same thing. And they purchased the building, and we collaborated on the construction of the remodeling of that building. So now we have 33 units in Valparaiso serving the needs of these single, low-income women. We're attempting to do the same thing for men as we speak.
I noticed you mentioned that in my notes that you are talking with city officials to try to get this 16-unit efficiency apartment building for low-income men underway. And you mentioned Housing Opportunities. It's another project that you're working in conjunction with them, I understand.
Yeah, we'll collaborate with Housing Opportunities. We'll co-own it and co-manage it. The issue is where it's going to be, and that's the somewhat contentious issue with the city of Valparaiso.
Well, I know the city's been working for years, it seems, in fact, under former Mayor John Casas, to try to find ways to create more affordable housing for residents in Valparaiso. So it looks like that at least there are other projects that are underway as well that will work toward that goal, I would think.
I think the city has an ear for this. But the marketplace is headed in the other direction.
Mm-hmm.
Just in the last couple of years, property values have increased dramatically, such that an old beat-up house that I could buy for $80,000 now costs $150,000. And nobody is building new affordable housing. Nobody in the marketplace.
Are you finding, besides the economy and the demand, of course, is just so high in Valparaiso, that's the reason that its demand is outstripping the availability of houses?
Clearly. The realtors that I talk to say that a house under $200,000 goes on the market in one day, and it's sold by that evening.
Wow.
In many cases, with offers exceeding the listed price. With that atmosphere, profit-seeking developers and builders, you know, if they're true to capitalism, have no recourse except to aim for the upper dollar marketplace.
We're talking with Paul Schreiner, who's executive director of Project Neighbors in Valparaiso. And Paul, I understand that among other projects that you have been working on or are working on is a new duplex. Will you tell us how you got into the duplex building basis these days rather than just apartments?
Well, our initial mission was to house families with children. And I used to have a formula for purchasing ground. If I could buy vacant land for $15,000 per unit, I could build something very, very affordable. Well, quickly, there's nothing around for $15,000 that's buildable. So I doubled it and said if I could buy it for $30,000 and put a duplex on it, I could meet my goal. Well, we have, the market has even outstripped that. So even though we're having to pay more money for buildable land, we cut the cost per unit down in half by putting a duplex on it. So that's why we went to duplexes rather than single-family houses.
I see. Mm-hmm. I understand that, that the Project Neighbors has a great opportunity that's always there for people that want to volunteer to help, and that's how I understand how a lot of these building projects get underway, don't they?
We use the Habitat model with one exception. We don't mandate that the person that's going to live there participate in it.
Mm-hmm.
And one can argue that's a good thing or a bad thing. I'm not going to talk about that. But volunteers are absolutely crucial to the success of our effort, and I find volunteers eager to participate. And we simply use an informal system of letting folks know what's going on, when it's going on, and they show up over and over and over.
That's good to hear. I understand that not only is Project Neighbors involved in, I guess, projects like this to be sure that there's affordable housing for people that need it the most, whatever the situation may be for them, but you're also very interested in getting the word out and working with people, and especially with minority students in the community. And maybe that comes back to your original goal to provide housing for Black families in the Valparaiso area that want to get out of the ghettos, literally. But you have an opportunity to help talk about minority students and the experiences they have in schools. And I understand that this has kind of led to a series of broadcasts that the community radio station is in Valparaiso is doing. Will you tell us a bit more about that?
A couple of years ago, a group of citizens got together that were sensitive to what it's like to live in a predominantly white community and be different. They formed a somewhat of a coalition amongst themselves, and they call themselves Allies Against Racism. In the course of exploring what happens to people of color or people of a different ethnic background, a group of students from the local high school were interviewed to talk about their experience in the Valpo schools. Those interviews we have turned into a six-part or a six-episode radio broadcast on the local community radio station, essentially replaying their commentary and adding some other voices to it to explore what's it like to be a Muslim in Valpo High School. What's it like to be a Black? What's it like to be gay? And it's very, very informing for those of us who don't have that experience to see that not everybody has the same experience in the public schools. So our effort is simply to inform people and perhaps to bring about some change in how those problematic experiences are dealt with.
Do you use an opportunity there with these programs to not only get the voices of the young people, the students in Valparaiso High School, but people in the community who may either be family members or work closely with them to kind of flesh out and answer some of the questions they might bring up?
What we try to do is we try to provide the original voices that we interviewed almost a year ago now with some, and I want to use this word very loose, some expert commentary. In other words, we have two show hosts, and they're just great. One is actually a high school senior. She is Muslim. She was born and raised in Valparaiso, and amazingly bright young lady, and the other is a local pastor. They host the show, and so they provide their own personal commentary. But for each episode, depending on whether it addresses issues of African American discrimination in the schools, or ethnic discrimination, or gender identity discrimination, we provide somebody that has some expertise in those areas to sit in and comment on what are the implications, what's the impact, how do students deal with this, how should the schools deal with this. So yeah, we're pulling in the rest of the community to the extent that you can on a radio show.
Right. Do you think that once the series, the six-part series is complete, they get some feedback? You're probably looking for feedback even while the programs are being aired. Get some feedback from the community to see if these topics strike a note? Maybe a nerve in some people's cases and result in some action?
at the end of each broadcast, we offer the listener an email address to send their comments to. And we hope to extend those who favor addressing these issues through that. And I can tell you that since we've just premiered the first episode Monday morning, I personally have received a number of actual phone calls. I don't know if the email address has received anything because I'm not on that end of it.
Right.
But it is our hope to extend the interest in this topic to a wider community, for sure.
Well, Paul, thank you for spending time talking about the projects that Project Neighbors in Valparaiso have been involved in, including finishing up a second respite house that will help residents who are recovering from addiction, and, of course, the continuing projects that are also underway, and the plans to hopefully build more efficiency apartments in Valparaiso to help people out. Thank you for being with us today to talk about it.
Thank you, Chris.
You're welcome. Paul Schreiner is the Executive Director of Project Neighbors in Valparaiso.
Regionally Speaking with host Chris Nolte can be heard each Monday through Thursday at noon on Lakeshore Public Radio 89.1 FM and streaming online at lakeshorepublicradio.org, where you can also find podcasts of the show when you click on the program link. For the latest in local news and information, tune in Monday at 6 a.m. for Morning Edition with local host Chris Nolte. Lakeshore Update is supported by the listeners and members of Lakeshore Public Radio, 89.1 FM. Podcasts for Lakeshore Update are posted each Friday on our website, lakeshorepublicradio.org, as well as on NPR One. Make sure you search for WLPR and select us as your home station. Music for Lakeshore Update was written and produced by BenSound.com. For Lakeshore Update, I'm Dee Dotson.